This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. All along the Civic Media Radio Network, it's the Matt McNeil Show for your Tuesday. Good to be with you, Matt and Brett, today. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Phone calls are welcome. A little bit later on in the 4 o'clock hour from the Minnesota Reformer, Patrick Cooligan is going to join us. We'll talk about some of his latest articles that he's put out there, including the campaign finance stuff in Minnesota, which we'll get to in the 4 o'clock hour. Brett, how are you today?
Oh, I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm doing okay, although I had an interesting conversation last night with two of my dear friends. Went to broadcasting school with them years ago, stayed friends, and they are just, my friends Chuck and Sean. And every once in a while, especially during the pandemic, we basically have done a Zoom call and talked, and it's basically become a great way for us to catch up. And so we spend usually 2 or 3 hours just sitting and talking, having a beverage and chatting about things. And we got into a discussion, and one of the things we always get into discussion about is movies and streaming and music and concerts and stuff like this. We get on to the entertainment stuff because my friend Sean was at those final Rush concerts in Los Angeles, the last ones they played before Neil Peart died. I'm like, oh, man, I mean, just a huge music fan. And he's actually talking about going down and catching U2's residency in Vegas when they go down there. That's going to be a pricey ticket, I'm going to guess.
Sounds like he's maybe even a bigger Rush fan than you.
Okay, way to hurt me. No. Hurt me early in the show. I'll just be over here crying. Thanks, Brett.
Is
there anything? We're all just fans. And by the way, for all the people who are listening to us in beautiful Madison, Wisconsin on Devil Radio, as well as Columbus on WTTN 1580, Waukesha 540 AM WAUK and 101 FM The Shaw and in Milwaukee area as well as Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950. I am a huge fan of the band Rush. I've long time fan and I love them. But anyway, that's a side story. We'll get to that another day. So we talked music. We got into talking about streaming services and I want to kind of go through really quick just because of I'm 53. I was born in 68. When I was born, you had 3, maybe 4, maybe if you were lucky, 5 TV channels. Maybe if you were lucky, you had, PBS, ABC, NBC, CBS. And then this is before Fox hit the airwaves. Then you might have a WGN out of Chicago or a TBS, WTBS out of Atlanta, WOR out of New York. That was one of those things that was carried regionally. But you had that. And when they started cable television, and boy, gosh, this seems like, wow, 30 choices. And one of them is just weather. I'll watch that all day long. It's like Bravo actually had like operas and stuff on it at that point, as opposed to Screaming Housewives.
I guess that would make sense when the title of the network is Bravo.
If you would think. You wouldn't believe what was on the History Channel. Actual history, as opposed to Lumberjacks on Ice Road.
I remember those days when they actually had history.
Yeah, exactly. MTV aired music videos. I know. I sound old. Anywho. But one of the things that was interesting back then when they launched these channels is you did have entertainment channels like TBS. And this might have even been before USA was out, but they would go get these classic TV shows and airmen syndication. And reminder, TV shows used to have like a 26 episodes run every year, just a ton of episodes, 24, 26. They would do that every year. And, so they had all these, just huge, stockpiles of shows. I was just watching the WKRP in Cincinnati. I got that DVD set with all the original music on it, which was great. And, I forget how many episodes that show actually had. I think it got close to 100. So you had a ton of shows. And so they could air them on these cable networks because they were still desperate for anything to air in the mornings. you know, especially in the mornings, you know, from 9 until noon. So they would put on Gilligan's Island. I mean, this is back when original cable TV came on. And then it, you know, it obviously then the cable channels, cable boxes expanded. You started getting, you know, 60 channels, 100 channels. Now I'm going to guess I've got somewhere on my system right now 200, maybe more. Most of them I never watched.
Yeah, even the standard cable packages are right around that number, 100 or 200.
And then I got, and but here's the crazy thing is, then I even have like on the one TV I have, I got what TV Plus is a Sony, so it's got TV Plus streaming, so I can watch the Bob Ross channel, watch that dude paint paintings all day long, which is by the way incredibly entertaining. That or This Old House or classic Doctor Who. I know, huge nerd. Okay, I got lots of issues. I'll unpack them over the days. Anyway. So you have all this stuff, and so we're at to a point where your entertainment choices have expanded. Now, and it was great because you could, I mean, for a while there, they were pulling out these obscure TV shows that aired for maybe one season or two seasons that would, you know, they were airing just because they there were so many channels and they just didn't have enough to air. You know, it's, you know, ESPN was airing Australian rules football because they couldn't, they didn't have any of the major contracts back then, so they're just desperate to get stuff on the air. But as you fast forward and we get to the internet and we get to streaming services and stuff, one thing that has just changed, and we were talking about this last night, is that, okay, I came back. I had a vacation earlier this year, and I came back, and I had to, because of the TV shows I was watching, and they're all streaming, I had The Boys, Umbrella Academy, Stranger Things, Only Murders in the Building, the Obi-Wan Kenobi, I had to catch the end of that. Miss Marvel as well. I had all these shows I had to watch. And I got into this discussion with my friends. It's like, okay, I love The Rockford Files. James Garner was fantastic. Rockford Files. You ever watch that show when you were a kid? Anything?
I did not know.
Great show. Just a really good show. Jim Rockford. Just love the show. I will probably never watch that show again. Not because it's not good. It's just I'm at a war of attrition here. I mean, we were talking about Better Call Saul, and Better Call Saul is a phenomenal show. Is a phenomenal show. You know, at what point are you going to sit down and watch all the episodes of that? It will take like a medical crisis for you to be in a bed to watch it all. I tried to watch Frasier. I mean, I love Frasier. Frasier was a great show. And I love Frasier, and I started trying to watch it, and it's like 11 seasons.
Oh, and they're not short seasons either,
they're,
as you brought
no,
up.
They're, yeah. There are these long seasons that are out there. Unbelievable. I mean, I watched like 5 episodes. I said, I can't do it. I like Wings. That was 8 seasons. Same, oh, once
really?
Again, long
eight seasons. Wow.
That was surprising, yeah. I had 8 seasons of Wings. I was trying to watch that. I can't, you know, I love The X-Files. X-Files was a great show. When am I going to have time to sit down and watch 20-some hours of one season of that show? It just because it's not just the fact that you're a busy person, you have all these things out there. It's I've got this never-ending stream of new shows that keep coming at me. So it's almost as if all these shows are going to be lost in time. And don't get me wrong. I know there are people out there like, I love, you know, Columbo. I love F Troop, you know, and they watch that. There are certain things which I like to watch that if it's on, I'll probably at least watch the end of that episode. But, you know, even for a TV geek, a kid that grew up in the age where you got home, you had 4 channels, you tried to find something to watch, you watched all the episodes of Gilligan's Island and the Brady's Bunch and Three's Company and Happy Days and all these shows, Laverne and Shirley, you knew all the episodes. Unless you get invested with a show early, is there any chance that you're going to revisit any of those episodes? I mean, The Walking Dead. Have you watched any of The Walking Dead?
Not in a long time, no.
I mean, how many seasons do you got to catch up on now? 9?
Oh, it's overwhelming. You're right. That's why I typically, too, have trouble getting into some of the old TV shows. There's just way too many episodes. It's such a time commitment to watch all of them.
My friend brought up what would be a great service, if someone went out there and basically watched a entire series. So have people watch entire series and say, if you want to get the vibe of this series, here are, you know, start with like a, let's just, Magnum P.I. How many years was that on? 8 years? 9 years?
Probably more than I would think after you brought up. Yeah, like Wings was on 8 seasons. Yeah.
So let's go with Magnum P.I. Let's say, and whatever, you know, if you want to catch the gist of this show in 5 episodes, here are the 5 episodes you should watch. Season 1, episode 1, season 2, episode 10, season 5, episode 26, season 6, episode 1. Just kind of go, you know, kind of give them that. Then say, if you'd like to delve in deeper, here are 12 episodes, including, you know, here are 7 more episodes on top of those, which will give you a better understanding on that. That would be a phenomenal service to have, to be able to look up any classic TV series, say, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer or you know, ER, and say, you know, ER, how many seasons was freaking ER on for?
Oh, good luck getting through that series.
Oh, God. So you have... Say, okay, if you want the best 5 episodes of this series, here are the 5 to watch. If you want a better understanding of the story arc of this, here's this. And just let people know. It's like, if you really want to understand the series, you got to watch the whole thing. But at least you could get an idea. You're down to a bite-sized amount, you know, 5 or 6 episodes. If it's a 30-minute TV show, you could do maybe 7 or 8 episodes. And you know, that's a Saturday night or, a rainy day on a weekend or something like that. You know, you just sit down and watch a few of those episodes. You can get the idea of the show. At least then you will just say, you could say to yourself, do I want to watch the rest of the show? Now, there are some shows that are like, you know, Friends and Seinfeld, people just love those still. But, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with those years down the road. It will be interesting. 952-946-6205. You think that's a good idea? Should we have like a prep sheet for all old TV shows? Maybe it's not the worst idea. 952-946-6205. Take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Say you miss me. Say you want to kiss me. I liked it better when you improvise a story we had.
It's the Matt McNeil Show on your Tuesday. 952-946-6205. I wonder if I've just given away a billion dollar idea. Trading on Wall Street, Elon Musk trying to buy me out sort of idea. Did I just do that?
I think it's a great idea. Yeah. You and I were talking before the break. Peacock kind of does that with The Office, where they have like fan favorite episodes, Parks and Rec as well. But that's not quite to the extent you're talking, which I think is a great plan. You know, here's an overview of the series.
Entertainment Weekly used to do that. And, you know, when there was magazines, remember that? when we had paper on this bizarro planet. Entertainment Weekly used to occasionally do that, and they'd say, okay, if you want to watch here are the 5 best episodes of the show, you could watch this. No, this would be like, okay, you pick up, and it can be any show. I mean, we talk about The Office, Parks and Rec, the very popular shows of the last 20 years, but go back to like I Love Lucy and go back to, Father Knows Best, stuff like that. I mean, even the classic shows, you could actually sit there and say, okay, if you want to watch this show and get a good idea of this in 6 episodes, here are the 6 episodes to watch. If you want a better story arc on this, we'll give you this. And I think it would actually do a service because, I mean, unless you are a diehard fan of any of these classic TV shows, considering how much new product is constantly coming out, and not including reality shows and, you know, like Alone, where you're taking sovereign citizens and chucking them out in the woods. I mean, it's like you got these things coming down, so many of them. You know, will anyone watch them? So, I mean, it might be a great way to at least keep those shows relevant. And then and occasionally if a person finds a show that they like, they can go back and revisit the whole thing.
Yeah, I just did the math in my head. If you have a series that's on for 10 seasons, 26 episodes a season, you got to get through 260 episodes. That's a lot.
That's a month.
That's overwhelming.
That's a month. Wow. And that's a month of intense watching.
You can't binge that. You got to do several days of binge watching to get through a series that many episodes.
How would you put that in the contract for the Arizona quarterback? I don't know. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. If you take that idea and run with it, kids out there, make me a board member, okay? I mean, there you go. Can I be a board member of the company? Can I ring the bell on Wall Street when we go public? Can I do that? I'll be like your pet. 952-946-6205.
Or we just get an attorney and we play back this segment of the show and say, this was us. This was our idea at AM 950. Give us our royalties.
Oh, fake block. It was up for Arrested Development. Fake block. Yes. All right. So into the sad news. Nurses at the Mayo Clinic's Mankato Hospital. I talked about this yesterday. And I'm not talking about this once again just to talk about a Minnesota story. I'm just talking about it overall because once again, nurses at the Mayo Clinic's Mankato Hospital voted 213-181 to decertify their union on Monday, a significant blow to Minnesota's powerful nurses union, a victory for the anti-union activists. The decision to sever ties with the Minnesota Nurses Association, which represents about 22,000 nurses, comes more than 7 decades after nurses first unionized at the hospital. The effort was backed by the National Right to Work Foundation. Basically, it sounds like you had a billionaire's daughter in there basically leading the charge to get rid of this. And I want to just make sure we understand something. If they spend $1 million to kill the union, I guarantee you why they're doing that is to basically make millions eventually when they can cut staff and cut jobs and cut wages. Because I'm going to say this. I mean, to the nurses down in Mankato that just voted to do this, good luck. Good luck. I hope you are. I do. I hope truly you will be the first time I've ever heard of a union going away and wages get better and benefits get better. I'd love that. That would be great. That would be at least showing me that the private sector is caring for the workers again. I have never seen that. And as a matter of fact, your entire argument is hoping that the rest of the new union nurses stay strong in Minnesota so that the hospital will not chip away at your salary and benefits, which I'm going to tell you right now, they're going to chip away at your salary and benefits. I guarantee it. You will be, in 5 years, you are going to be making less money. You are going to have less benefits. It is. That's what happens. That's what happens in the vast majority of these cases. If you get rid of your union, well, good luck. Good luck. And I'm sure the anti-union rightos out there that is like, Democrats. I mean, is it when 5 years down the road, you're making less money, you got less benefits, you're not going to look in the mirror and say, wow, did I screw up? We should have never decertified the union. We probably should have, wow, that was a mistake. You're not going to do that. A lot of people have no ability to do that. What you're going to do is sit there and try to find someone else to blame for the problems that you created for yourself. It's the truth. You won't look at your own actions, your own culpability. You'll only look at trying to find someone else to blame for your mistake. I guarantee you, in a matter of time, that they're going to say, well, you're not having to pay union dues, so we can cut your salaries right there. And you're going to be like, oh, okay, I guess that makes sense. And then they're going to come on out and they're, like I said, they'll come out your benefits. I mean, this is just hypothetical, just making an example. But they might come on out and they'll say, you know, we're not going to cover eye care anymore. Or we're not going to cover dental. We'll cover no more 100% dental. It'll be 80-20. We'll do that. What? And then they'll start figuring out. So say you are a pediatric nurse. All right. Say you're a pediatric nurse. They'll look at the map and they'll figure out where the nearest hospital you could go work and get a better wage would be. And they'll say, okay, that's 40 to 50 miles away, which means basically every 2 days you're going to have to fill up a gas tank. You're going to be spending almost 2 hours on the road every day to drive from your house up there. So how much can we cut back on your wages and salary to where you'll just tolerate staying here versus leaving and actually going and getting another job? And that doesn't even include, by the way, as we've talked about yesterday, it doesn't even include the potential of the company saying, oh, well, you don't have a contract with us anymore. By the way, we're going to fire half of you and we're going to bring in some, you know, low wage, you know, $13 an hour nurses from Oklahoma. We'll ship them on up here. They'll work for three months. We give them a free hotel room. They go work, you know, 6 days a week, 10-hour shifts. and they get paid $13 an hour, and then we give them a bonus if they stay up for the whole time, and then we send them on back, and then we'll bring in the next group of $13 an hour nurses. And all of a sudden, you're sitting there saying, why isn't the union helping us? Well, you said you didn't need our help. You didn't need their help. You've got this. You believed the billionaire with the anti-union think tank. You thought that person was on your side. That's what it is. It should be noted that what happens with these union fights is a lot of times is that things are so bad that they can bring in a box of donuts for a few days. And they're like, oh, that's a good day. Or they can offer you a $20 gift card. And things are so bad, that $20 gift card, well, that's something you need right away. The reality is they want to get rid of unions because they can save millions and millions of dollars over time in a large institution by not paying you the wages and not paying you the benefits. Shame on you guys. This is a mess you created. Bon appetit. Let's take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on a Tuesday. Coming to you live on WAUK 540 AM 101 FM, The Shaw. Devil Radio 92.7 FM in Madison, WTTN 1580 AM in Columbus, and AM 950, the progressive voice of Minneapolis, St. Paul. It is the Matt McNeil Show on your Tuesday, 952-946-6205. By the way, reminded you, nurses work 12-hour shifts. Yes, and nurses work hard. And maybe this is one of the reasons why I'm just kind of stunned that nurses would try to certify their union. My God. You work hard. I understand this has been brutal. I have said for years, you're angels. You're absolute angels. You did not deserve what the Republicans unleashed on you guys across this country of raging lunatics screaming at you. You did not deserve that. People, I mean, my God, that story out of South Dakota, the nurse there trying to tell the man who's dying of COVID, who died of COVID, for God's sakes, you need to see your family. And the guy kept ripping off his mask and screaming, this is a myth. I'm not really dying. And he died. He died. You guys went through hell. And I am on your side 1,000%. That's why it's wildly disturbing and frankly, strange that you guys would vote to decertify a union anywhere. Because I can tell you right now, if you think things were bad before, and okay, can I make the point? If the entire argument of the people trying to decertify the union is, don't worry, the other unions will keep our wages high. Do you just not hear what you're saying? Oh, there's a benefit to the unions? What you're hoping for is to get the same thing the union gets without having to pay the union dues. I have once again, I have never seen a union or a group of workers who decertified a union or lost a union because of government, laws make more money and have more benefits 5 years later. Never. It's always less. You're getting paid less. You get less benefits. And when if you are in an institution where you're out kind of by yourself and you're not near another major hospital or a major metro area where you can kind of go and use that metro area as well, they got union nurses over there. I'll go over there. If you're by yourself, you really are in a pickle because I guarantee you they'll figure out, it seems to be $100 less per week. We'll keep them in check. We save the $100. Like I said, they're spending $1 million to kill the union. There's a reason why, because they're going to save tens of millions of dollars when they screw you over for benefits and wages. But you can't. At this point, you look around the country and you saw what the Republicans did in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s and 2010s in state after state where they went after unions, and you see the undeniable economic impacts to those workers. And you say to yourself, that sounds good to me. You know, I, I, don't, I don't quite know what to do with that. You know, face, and I'll bring this up because here's a different story. But once again, here we are talking about workers' rights. Faced with court rulings that say Trump administration directive doesn't protect Tyson Foods from liability caused by workers' deaths due to COVID-19, the food giant is now asking the U.S. Supreme Court to weigh in on the matter. So they're basically saying that the Trump administration directive did not protect Tyson Foods from liability caused by workers' deaths. And what should be mentioned, Tyson Foods treated their own employees horribly. Arguing that recent court rulings against the company will have drastic consequences for the next national emergency, Tyson told, or maybe you should have just treated your employees better. I mean, there's that. You could have done that, but, you know, that never, I guess, was really a consequence. Tyson told the nation's high court that private companies will not be so eager to willingly aid the federal government in a crisis if those rulings are allowed to stand. Okay, wait a second here. It's this is far more about whether, you know, did you treat your employees right? This is, you know, you're trying to hide there, it seems like. The recent decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Fifth Circuit, which echoed a decision last year by the Eighth Circuit Appeals Court, found the Trump administration March 2020 efforts to keep meatpacking lines open during the pandemic didn't shield the company from lawsuits alleging negligence. So what Tyson, I guess, is making the argument is we can be negligent as all get-go. That didn't matter. Those and other court decisions have paved the way for workers' lawsuits against Tyson to be heard in state courts in Iowa, Texas, and elsewhere, despite the company's efforts to move the cases to federal court. Court filings suggest that Tyson believes its argument that it was only doing business under the direction of the federal government will prove to be a more effective defense in federal court than in state court. Trump's March 2020 directive stated the Department of Agriculture had to take all appropriate action to ensure the nation's meat and poultry processors continued operations during a pandemic. But the companies had to operate in a manner that was consistent with guidance offered by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The directive stopped short of ordering the plants to remain open. Tyson has since been hit with what it calls a wave of litigation from former employees or representatives of former employees alleging they contracted COVID-19 because Tyson kept its plants operating in unsafe conditions, which we know. Tyson's stance is that since the plants continue to operate at the direction of federal officers, at the highest levels, the federal courts must resolve the claims related to injuries and deaths that stem from that action. In May, Tyson filed with the U.S. Supreme Court a petition seeking to extension of time in which it could file a petition of a writ of some Italian word in a case involving a deceased plant worker in Waterloo. In that case, the appeals court for the Eighth Circuit had affirmed the decision sending the matter to state court, stating the company was not acting under a federal officer in keeping its plants open operating. In its filings with the U.S. Supreme Court, Tyson now argues it was merely following the federal government's instructions to help avert the impending national food shortage, adding that Eighth Circuit's ruling will have a drastic consequences for the national emergency. Tyson says the private companies will not be so eager willingly to aid the government in the crisis. Okay, so once again, I want to make sure we understand something. The problem here wasn't that you needed to aid the country during the crisis. The problem here is that what appears to be, at least, allegedly, is that you sacrificed worker safety to try to make a quick buck. Because let's remind people, a lot of these meatpacking plants made tons of money, obscene amounts of money. So you basically just didn't put the safety protocols in place because that was going to be more expensive. And it was only when you started getting sued because your workers were dying that all of a sudden you frantically all of a sudden said, oh, we know we're going to put up the plastic shielding and stuff. You know, and by the way, if you look at processing plants in small town America, holy God, the impacts to those communities, those are the communities that got hit the hardest by COVID. And this is pre-vaccine levels. I mean, insane amounts of people dying in small town after small town, and most of it because the typhoid Mary center point of the disease, the petri dish itself, was the processing plant in town. And so it went way beyond just the working crew that was there, that was working in unsafe conditions. It was their families. It was all the people in the town who basically had nothing to do with and it might not have anything to do with the processing plant, but because they sat in a diner next to someone who worked there. The Supreme Court receives more than 7,000 petitions writ with them each, but agrees to hear arguments for roughly 80 cases. Just last week, three Iowa lawsuits against Tyson's were moved from state court to federal court. The plaintiffs and the families are Victor Rivera, who died on June 15, 2020, after working at Tyson for 27 years. Ken Jones, a 12-year Tyson employee, who died on June 3, 2020. And Juan Samudu, a 5-year employee of Tyson, who died on June 10th. The families allege Tyson was fully aware of the risks associated with COVID-19, but continued to expose workers to contamination by forcing them to work within 6 feet of one another without proper barriers between them or adequate personal protection equipment. They also claim Tyson imposed inadequate disinfecting and sanitizing procedures and failed to implement COVID-19 testing and screening. I can tell you there's a really easy way to see if, and I think the reason why Tyson is frantically trying to get this in the federal court is because there is going to be a very easy hurdle to cross for the plaintiffs here in this case. What was it like in the office where the executives worked? What was it like there in the plant office where the guys that don't work the line, was there safety shielding there? Was there mandatory PPE, personal protection equipment? Did you have that available to them? Because if you had any of that available to them, if you had protocols and rules saying, you know, you have to stay in your office, you can't come out of your office, you know, you have to be wearing your mask. The person that was working the front desk had the plexiglass shields. If they had all that stuff, guess what? Your argument's garbage. Then you didn't know that you needed to get that done. And you could have shut down that plant for 2 days and got a crew in there and got all that plexiglass up and gave all the people the equipment they needed and just chose not to. Just because the federal government asked you to do it doesn't mean that you're not liable when you did not protect your workers. And this is not just at this case in Iowa, but it's across the country. You used to have companies that cared about their employees, damn it. And they just don't anymore. Until a story like this comes on out and then they buy a few $1 million of freaking TV ads to sit there and say, hey, what makes you think we don't care about our employees? We, of course, love our employees. They're fantastic. They've done a lot of great work for us. As the morgue truck has taken the people out of the freaking hospital that their employees that they've got put there. It's just disturbing. And this is on top of when you hear stories of the guys betting on who would get sick on the line and stuff. How many people would get sick that day? Each of the three lawsuits names plant manager Rick Retzlaff, plant superintendent Nathan Carnine, plant safety manager Jorge Sandoval, and area safety manager Lori Garcia as defendants. Tyson denies the allegations. According to the court records, the company has denied the family's claims for workers' compensation benefits. Wow. Wow. But you're not sleazeballs. No, 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 no. All those people that died working for you, hey, you denying them workers' comp benefits. You're not the bad guys. Not at all. At the end of the day, the modern corporate mentality is money, 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 money. And the reason why is because the executive class has placed themselves over everyone else. And so if you dare do anything that's going to violate that money, 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 they will basically, this is what happens. It's just disturbing. And I want to remind people, these plants are still working in these same towns. And there are friends of these people who died that are still on the line. And what do you think the corporation's mentality is? Hey, no one talks about the people that died. No one talks about it. If you don't, is that what it is? I don't know what it is. This is the reason why, and here's the good news. Remember I was talking about the nurses and they just certified their union there. The vast majority, the number of organizing campaigns is up 50-some percent for unions in this country. Unions are actually making a pretty strong comeback. And I'm presuming Yeah, I mean, it depends on where each of these plants is located at. From what I've understood, it's the states that have those right-to-work laws. Those are the ones where most of the people died at some of these plants, not necessarily Tyson, but other plants. It's where there's no unions were allowed or, you know, it's only right-to-work stuff. We have a point. We're at a crossroads. And we either can get off the road right now or continue to go down this path where corporate executives who make millions of dollars each year, 20, 30, 50, 100, 300, 700 times more than the average worker on the floor, that they basically keep pushing this idea and this notion that there's got to be, you know, that the workers are not nearly as important as they need to be. This is why unions are needed. And this is why unions are needed across the board. People are tired of getting treated like crud at the job. And we don't deserve that. We deserve better. Good wages, good benefits, and not, oh gosh, getting killed. We'll take a break, come back. It's the Matt McNeil Show. The Matt McNeil Show here on your Tuesday, 952-946-6205. Dave is in Minneapolis, wanted to chime in this afternoon. Welcome on in, Dave.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Matt. You do have my favorite show in all of the Twin Cities in Minnesota.
Thank you.
I'm a big fan of yours. And I've talked before. And first of all, I want to say, yeah, the virus is a dangerous thing. It's not safe. And all those PPE things and all that is a great thing to be doing to stay safe. But one thing that I think it's lost because of our mainstream media is driven by profit and advertisers. And as you all know, there was a time when pharmaceutical companies couldn't advertise on TV and all that. They flipped the script on that so they can. But where I'm headed on this is the virus is actually, in biological scientific terms, it's a parasite. Okay, supposedly they tell us the Spanish flu, that was a virus, and that you and I and Brett and the rest and their audience all have like a weakened version of that, a weakened version such that it doesn't kill us. And a parasite doesn't want to kill its host. It wants its host to live forever, because otherwise if it dies, the host dies, the virus has nowhere to go. So where am I headed with this? As you realize the symptoms of the virus, the current variants, or whatever, the variants that are coming through, have been less and less harsh on a human body. It's still there, yeah, and that's not, you just don't want to get this stuff. But eventually, there is light at the end of the tunnel, because if the Spanish flu can be weakened and we're all carrying it, same thing holds true for every single virus that ever occurs on the planet.
So Dave,
but what I'm saying is, we're spending money on some things that probably are of no use and could be allocated elsewhere, because there's a big pharmaceutical industry, which if you look at history, the ones that are engaged, they are from oil companies. The first pharmaceutical companies.
Dave, if I can cut on in here, by the way, first of all, I'm going to get Dr. Joe Eastman, our COVID modeling expert. He's going to join us on Thursday. And we're going to sit down and chat with him on Thursday and talk a little bit more about this. You know, it was COVID when it came through. It was scary. I remember those days. It was scary. We didn't know what was going to happen. And you know, I can understand being wary of it, but at the same time, when you're not really doing anything to try to keep your employees safe, what did you think was going to happen? 952-946-6205. So one of the things I think is my job here is to try to keep you up to date on Republican strategy for the fall. I try not to do that too much. It hurts. Anyway. So it's something I have seen a lot of lately. So gas prices are coming down. Republicans, they were all ready to go with those Joe Biden did this gas pump stickers. Yes, nothing funnier than people complaining about $2 more per gallon of gas, buying hundreds of dollars worth of stickers to vandalize gas pumps with. You're all idiots. Anyway, gas prices have been coming down 6 weeks in a row now. Inflation is tough. Wages are up dramatically, but I also say is unemployment is down dramatically. We actually have got a country that's getting back to work. That's for sure. That being said, I do want to take a quick moment, if I may, to point out the Republicans are going to fall back to one position this election cycle, and that's crime. A few years ago, I had a friend of mine, dad I used to know through baseball. My son played baseball, and I knew him. His son played baseball. We knew each other. And one day on Facebook, he made this post about, I went downtown, and I'll tell you what, we're lucky we got out of that urban hellscape alive. You know, it was one of those things. I'm like, wow, what happened? Well, we came out of the restaurant, and there was a homeless man. And it's a major metropolitan city. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to be glib about homelessness, but there's homeless people all throughout the metro area. It's not like your life is in jeopardy because there's a homeless person there. There was a guy panhandling. For God's sakes, there's a guy panhandling pretty much at every exit ramp off the interstate in this country at this point. Where was your life in jeopardy? And what it was it wasn't what actually happened. It's what happened in their mind. Oh, if this would have happened or this would have happened. Oh, my God. I had a friend of mine tell me today that he went downtown in downtown Minneapolis and he went down to a restaurant down there. And the valet at the restaurant told him, just run every red light. Just get out of town. I'm like, what? So the valet, let me get this right. The valet was so concerned about carjacking, he's telling them to run red lights throughout the metro. You could call the police. I mean, if you know there's carjackers down on a certain street, you might, call the police and let them know they're down there as opposed to just trying to scare everybody. And by the way, not carjacked. You are going to get more and more of this as it goes, because the reality is that this is pretty much the only issue that looks like it's going to resonate. And especially in the post-Roe v. Wade world, where the Republicans are already at a disadvantage because they're the party that wants to basically control women's bodies. They're gleefully looking to get rid of gay marriage. They're gleefully looking to get rid of contraception. They want to, some of them want to bring back sodomy laws to dictate what kind of sex you can have with your partner in your own private bedroom. That's the Republican Party today. So they've got to find an issue. So you need to prepare yourself for the theater of the mind. I was out going to the store. Somehow gets translated into, I was running Damnation Alley, guns a-blazing. Did you get down there to try to get some cheesy poofs? I saw a man panhandling. There was a mad gunman spraying bullets everywhere. The reality is, and I'll post this story out there. There was a phenomenal analysis done by Bloomberg, and he specifically is looking at New York City. And when he factored in all causes of death outside of drug overdoses, medical surgeries that went wrong and stuff like this, they got rid of some of these kind of non-traditional things that really weren't good for the evaluation. They just looked at car accidents. They looked at other accidents that happened. And they looked across the board at the amount of cases per 100,000 in the population. Metro areas are some of the safest places on the freaking planet. Do you know where it's most dangerous in this country? Rural America. It is. It is unbelievable. When you factor in the numbers, it is insane how much more dangerous it is in rural America than metro area. The safest area are the suburban areas around the metro areas. But the second safest area are the metro areas themselves. Then comes small outlying cities that are standalone cities. And then it comes rural areas. they're not safe. I'll put the Bloomberg story out there. You got to read it. It is amazing analysis from earlier in June. Madison, Waukesha, Milwaukee, stand by. I got Devil Radio. Minneapolis, St. Paul, hour two of the Matt McNeil Show. That's up next right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Hour number two. By the way, I mentioned this story last hour, but I didn't want to say this on the network so much, but the valet, apparently at Manny's, is the guy that tells people to just get in your car and run every red light, man. Just run for your lives.
I would put their percentage at like maybe a 10% chance he's just messing with people, too.
I could be there. It's actually that point, too. But apparently, I need to call Manny's and say, is this what you guys are doing? Because I don't think that that's helping the image of the downtown. I don't think that's helping them. Run for your lives. Did you enjoy your meal? Oh, here's your swan. And don't stop. Run the red light. I mean, is the valet driver actually telling people to run red lights?
I mean, seriously. Marketing campaign. I kind of want to go to Manny's now and see if I get that guy telling me to run for my life.
If you get T-boned at an intersection, well, guess what? That gets you over at Manny's. A T-bone. God. I hope the valet guy down there isn't telling people to do that. I would hope not. Even if it's just joshing with these, here's an uptight person from the suburbs. Even if it is. I would hope that they're not telling people to run red lights.
Yeah, that's kind of insane. Get out of here. Run!
Run! Don't stop!
They're escaping from an apocalypse.
I was looking at the numbers. Even Minneapolis, as people are like, oh, Minneapolis is a hellscape. Minneapolis is like the eighth best metro area, safest metro area in the entire country. And that includes all like the metro areas, like Waukesha, or not, Sheboygan, Wisconsin's on there. Mankato's on there. Minneapolis, St. Paul is an insanely safe place. Go to freaking Baltimore, man. You want tough. But this is what we're going to get because, what did I say? The jobs numbers, did you see the story? Minnesota has the lowest unemployment ever recorded for any state. It has never been this low. Thank you, Governor Walz. Thank you, Governor Walz. Gas prices are coming down. Roe v. Wade is a nightmare issue for them. So it's all about, my God, a crime could have happened. They could have had a nuclear bomb. Thank God John McClane was there. You know, that's going to be what it is. It was like that. You see the story that was about the light rail line down in at the airport and the woman fretting that she had to go from one terminal to the next on the light rail line?
Oh, yeah.
Because there was a homeless person there and it smelled bad. Okay. And one guy was looking at me. So nothing happened. That's irrelevant. It could have happened. No, it's actually everything. You know, there's not a crime there. You just took a subway ride. You took the LRT. That's you felt uncomfortable. Sorry, but nothing bad happened. And that's kind of how it works.
And you post on social media, that just feeds the exaggerated narrative,
exactly.
Too.
Exactly. It's a lot of people pushing these. It's a hell. I mean, okay, I was down. I went to Sweat at the Guthrie. That was on Friday. I was at Bademikoska, which, Minneapolis, you know, fine. Beautiful, as a matter of fact. Lovely lake. Lovely lake. I went to the Armory for that Rex Orange County show where I was the oldest guy there. Went to there. I was at Rock the Garden. I went down for my anniversary. I was downtown. We had dinner downtown. Had a delightful time. I've been downtown a ton. We just hiked the historic mile down there. We crossed the Stone Arch Bridge. This is before they set up the fireworks for the Aquatennial, but we walked that. We went over and did that whole route. My daughter marched in the Aquatennial Parade with her high school band. Now, the next thing you'll hear is, well, those areas don't count. Those were areas where people were. So that doesn't count. You can only go with what's in my mind. Dude, it's like the story in the Bring Me the News today. The guy whose son got, hit. Now, I feel sorry for him. You got your phone stolen. That's bad. All my best. It's 2 a.m. outside of a bar. Not much good happens 2 a.m. outside of a bar.
And if you're sitting there saying, hey, I'm on my phone, here's my phone, why don't you just count your money out while you're out there too? I mean, it does happen. And it happens everywhere. It happens. You see those small towns? People getting robbed outside of those bars too. They are. It's just it's the paranoia of the mind. Matt is in Minneapolis, wanted to chime in. Welcome on in, Matt.
Hey, Matt. It's great to hear your show back at it, the time that it was. You know, I kind of want to bring up something. Like, I'm from the Mid-Atlantic region. I'm from Philadelphia. And this city is nowhere near like what it's like back in the Mid-Atlantic or any giant major metropolitan area. It's like the inner city part feels like the outer tier suburbs to me.
I mean, it's like it does.
It you know, and they talk about alleys out here like oh, you know, it's a freaking driveway for crying out loud. It's not even like the back alley where you're like, whoa, I better be careful walking in the back alleyway that's only 3 feet wide.
No, your point is exactly on. It's what you have in Minneapolis is. I'm not saying crime is. There's no crime here. There is crime here. I'm not saying some of it's not bad. Of course, some of it's bad. But if you're trying to make this out to, you know, some sort of war-torn country in a third world country, no, it's Minneapolis is still actually a pretty safe place.
You know, I mean, where my mom's house is situated, I grew up in fairly close to where the MOVE bombing happened in the 80s. And
yeah.
I actually felt that bomb hit. And so, which kind of brings me up on another issue that I have with, like, you know, a lot of, like, the Fox News outlets and whatnot were trying to portray the riots as, like, Black Lives Matter and George Floyd and whatnot, which really isn't true because there were people from outside of our neighborhood, Umbrella Man,
And Matt, if I can step on in here, and thank you very much for the phone call.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, last I checked, pretty much most of the people that have been arrested and charged were white guys from outside of the metro area. Most of them have been. All of them with allegiances to far right groups. Boogaloo Boys, guys like that. Yeah, no, the MOVE bombing, remember that? Out in Philadelphia? The city decided to bomb its own residents.
Wait,
Your God.
Wow, I got to read about this.
I was in Philadelphia for a church youth group at that point when I was a kid.
Oh, so you were there when this happened?
No, I wasn't there. We were there right afterwards.
Okay.
And there was, we were in this church, and this church, by the way, in Philadelphia, to get in, I mean, you had, it was like a prison to be in the church. I mean, they had barbed wire, they had all these, this is Philly, man. And we're down doing mission work down there. And it was a good trip, you know, nothing bad. A much rougher city than Minneapolis. The guy was a guy with a boombox out there, and apparently one of the local DJs was playing the roof is on fire for these guys. I'm like, wow, this town, man, Philly. Philly is an interesting city, man. But it is. People that are here, it's nervous, scared, tertiary suburb white people who are, it's a hellscape. Dude, when has Minneapolis ever been a 1,000 person country town where I'm going for a stroll on a Saturday night? When has that ever happened? Doc Ames in the 1900s. The Skid Row project, for God's sakes, where, oh God, they had to knock down all those buildings. Rows, block after block of abandoned buildings. Hennepin Avenue was a freaking pit up until about 1990. An absolute disaster area. You guys want to make it seem like, well, we used to go on out there and put on our Sunday finest and just stroll down the street while licking ice cream. No, you didn't. It just is political season. And if the Republicans have to convince you of the crimes that go on inside their mind are real, tells you a little bit about what they're really bringing to the table. They've got to scare you with irrational scenarios to get you to vote for them. Ta-da! Is it really, I mean, is that hard for these people? When one guy, I saw this guy. You know what he could have done?
morphed into a robot man and turned into a truck. That would have been so cool.
It makes a cool story, though.
Oh, it does.
Especially when you put that on your Facebook page and you get all those comments saying, wow, glad you're safe. And all
Oh, thank God. Thank God. Thank God you're safe. Yeah. Not saying crime doesn't happen. No one's saying this town doesn't have, you know, some blemishes, by all means. But, dude, trying to turn this town into the worst city in America, please. We need to go to Baltimore. You know, Edgar Allan Poe was the happy guy they had in that town. Okay, let's just put it that way. 952. Here's Johnny Drury to cheer us up. 952-946-6205. When we come back, you've got an interview with Cooligan, right?
Indeed, yeah. Talking with Patrick Cooligan. We're talking a little bit about campaign finance numbers. Also, we briefly touch on the Minnesota the Mankato nurses down with the Mayo Clinic and how they decertified their union. And Patrick wrote a column on Matt Burke and how the Walls campaign can make sure they keep their focus and not let that ticket win.
We'll do that there. Hey, let's brighten up the day with the telltale heart guy. Let's take a break. Come on back. When we do return, Brett with Patrick Cooligan from the Minnesota Reformer. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. As today we're joined by Patrick Cooligan, who is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, great resource for the latest in Minnesota news and politics over at minnesotareformer.com. Today on the agenda, we are going to be talking about Patrick's column on Matt Burke and how the Walls campaign might need to be a little bit more bold in terms of trying to make sure they win this fall. We'll also be talking about new campaign finance numbers and nurses voting at the Mayo Clinic to decertify their union. Patrick, thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Always a pleasure, Brett.
Absolutely. So let's start off with your column titled, "The Sacking of Matt Burke Won't Last Forever, So Walls Needs to Be Bold." And in your column, you bring up how Burke has made, well, no shortage of really abhorrent quotes over the past few weeks and months, including one back in June where he said, quote, "Our culture loudly but also stealthily promotes abortion. They're telling women they should look a certain way. They should have careers, all these things," unquote. So certainly there's no shortage of bad quotes from Matt Burke. But you bring up the very good point that the Walls campaign can't just rely on Matt Burke gaffes to win this fall, because Matt Burke's running mate, Scott Jensen, is a very skilled campaigner and has a good chance of winning this fall. So what challenges could the Walls campaign be facing in the coming months and weeks that could be trouble for that campaign, where they just aren't going to be allowed to rely on these gaffes from the Burke campaign?
Yeah, I mean, what kind of motivated me to write this was a lot of the snickering that I was hearing from people in my own kind of social and political circles here in the Twin Cities. And whenever people around me are all in kind of agreement, that's when I start to get nervous. And they were, of course, snickering over some of these Burke comments. And then later in the week, a couple of restaurants that had something called the Matt Burke Burger took his name off the menu. And it's just, it seemed like, wow, this was a ticket of Jensen and Burke was just such an easy one for Tim Walz to topple in the fall. And I just don't think that's the right attitude going into the fall. When your own president in the White House is, his approval numbers are in the 30s. And when your own record, speaking now of Governor Tim Walz, has been one crisis after another, I'm not going to say that they're of his own making or that this is his own fault. But if you look back at the last 4 years with a pandemic and an increase in crime and now inflation, this is not the kind of political environment that you want to be complacent about if you're Tim Walz and the Democrats. And I don't think it's good enough to just rely on the Matt Burke's abortion extremism or Scott Jensen's vaccine and COVID extremism, because it's very possible this campaign will be refocused in the fall on issues that are much less friendly to Governor Walz, and that is inflation and crime.
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of reminds me back to the summer of 2016, where a lot of people thought, well, look at Donald Trump making all these gaffes on the campaign. Hillary Clinton is leading by the polls and a lot over that summer. And then all of a sudden, lo and behold, Election Day, the race tightens and Trump ends up winning. So there are some parallels there where you can't just rely on the gaffes from your opponents. But in your column, you also bring up some things that Walz could be doing that could improve his standing for this fall, including calling a special session. Go into a little bit more in terms of what the Walz campaign could be doing to help themselves out for this fall.
Yeah, only the governor can call a special session. And we ended the legislative session in May without any kind of a deal, and so there's a big surplus. So what Walz could do is call a special session and say, lawmakers, you need to come back to St. Paul, and you need to help Minnesotans who are struggling with rising costs, especially food and energy. There's enough there to give every family $2,000. You know, the conventional wisdom is the Republicans won't go along with it because they don't want a one-time payment to taxpayers. What they want is a permanent tax cut. And they also feel like they want to wait until they have potentially a Republican House and Senate next year. And who knows, maybe even a Republican governor. And then that way they can use the surplus however they want. You know, but I think that's going to be, it would be tough for Republicans to say, no, we're not going to give every Minnesota family $2,000. I don't think that's a good message for them going into the fall. But if they decide to say no, well, that's okay. Then that's a great issue for Walz to run on. And being that he's the governor, he's going to be the one, he's the one with the bigger megaphone. And he can really, I think, frame the entire election around the fact that to no fault of his own, inflation is at a 40-year high, and he wants to do something about it. He wants to give Minnesota families $2,000, and Republicans don't. So I don't know. I think there's something to be said for that tactic, but I don't really – I actually don't think they're going to do it because it's just riskier. And the conventional wisdom is you never call back the legislature unless you've got an agreement in writing ahead of time. And that's because once they're in session, they can do whatever they want. And so you don't want to lose control like that. But I think the reality is this year that Republicans don't want to be, the Republican-led Senate doesn't want to be in session because it's just going to point to the fact that they can't get anything done and that they're saying no to $2,000 for every Minnesota family. So we'll see what they do, but I suspect that Walz is going to take the risk-averse approach.
And speaking of that race between Walz and Jensen, let's go into some campaign finance numbers that were out this week, and they show that Walz has $5 million of cash on hand compared to Scott Jensen, who only has $581,000 of money on hand. So I'm curious what your take is on these numbers, because that's a pretty big advantage for the Walz campaign, especially being that they already have a number of ad reservations placed on TV and radio stations this fall, while I believe the Jensen campaign still has yet to make any of those reservations. What do you make of these numbers so far? Could they change if more national groups get involved, or is this largely going to be a campaign where Walz is going to have the cash and advertising advantage?
I think there's no question he's going to have an advantage. The question is whether or not outside groups, and especially the Republican Governors Association, is willing to come in and help Jensen. And I think to do that, they're going to have to show evidence that, that Jensen's making some progress, both on the fundraising front and in the polls. But it does look like Walz has been extremely prodigious in his fundraising, and certainly he's going to have the money to blanket the airwaves later in this race. And there's an argument to be made that he ought to be defining Jensen right now before Jensen has the cash to respond. The counter argument to that is, well, nobody knows who Scott Jensen is. I mean, his name recognition statewide is still not that big. So why would you elevate him and essentially pay to have his name recognition increase. So that, I'm sure that's an interesting discussion within the Walls campaign. But big cash advantage. And from, I've talked to not that campaign, but other campaigns have told me that since Roe v. Wade was overturned, there's really been a significant increase in donations to Democratic campaigns. And that small donor network the Democrats have developed, especially since Trump's election in 2016, especially, I think, single women, suburban women, who were outraged and are fearful of the future with the Supreme Court and Republicans around the country passing anti-abortion rights bills. They've really stepped up to campaigns.
And it's not just the governor's race where we are seeing DFL candidates with an advantage over their Republican opponents. If we look at the AG race, Keith Ellison, the incumbent, has $573,000 of cash on hand. The Republican, Jim Schultz, only has $113,000. Doug Wardlow also has $35,000. He's challenging Schultz for the Republican nomination. Secretary of State, also the same deal, where Steve Simon, the DFLer, $679,000 on hand. Kim Crockett, only about $178,000. And even if we look at the state parties, the DFL, I believe, has about $2.5 million. The Republicans, only $294,000. So I'm curious what is causing this. You were hinting that possibly it is just this network of small donors for the DFL, but I would think in a very favorable election cycle for the Republicans, they would be doing a little bit better in terms of their campaign numbers. What do you make of the DFL usually holding these big advantages in pretty much all of these races around the state? And what's causing it?
Yeah, I mean, some of it is that big donors don't have a lot of confidence, the kinds of big donors that Republicans want and need to make up some of that gap. I just don't think they have much confidence after this 15-year losing streak. They just don't have the confidence that Republicans can win a statewide race. So that's part of it. Democrats have been really the dominant fundraising player in Minnesota for a number of years. And so some of that just builds on itself. And then there's the power of incumbency. I mean, you know, if you are somebody who's got business before state government or works in a regulated industry, you don't really want to go against the incumbent. And I understand none of us like the implications of that, but that's the reality. So it's a kind of combination of factors people just are not that confident that Republicans can win here statewide, even though it does appear to be a favorable year for them.
Speaking with Patrick Houlihan, editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, make sure you go to minnesotareformer.com. Last story to briefly talk about, and this has to do with nurses at the Mayo Clinic, as 500 nurses at Mayo Clinic's Mankato Hospital decided to decertify their union with the Minnesota Nurses Association. The effort was led by Glenn Taylor's stepdaughter with help from the National Right to Work Foundation. Tell us a little bit about their efforts and how they were able to convince their nurses to decertify their union, because this was a big blow to unions in Minnesota and ends a very long relationship that this union had over the years in terms of being around and advocating for their workers and their nurses.
Right. Mayo Clinic, at the flagship hospital in Rochester, they're not unionized, and presumably it's because they have excellent pay and benefits there. But they do have these unionized nurses at the Mankato facility, which is they've acquired, and so they were grandfathered in there. It's certainly interesting that Glenn Taylor, the Minnesota mogul, billionaire, former Republican state senator, owner of the Star Tribune and the Timberwolves, that it's his stepdaughter who helped run that campaign to decertify the union. And they apparently had some sort of a organizing party at the Taylor residence. we found that to be an interesting wrinkle. I think that the, you know, their argument here is that Mayo Clinic pays its nurses very well, and you can earn those wages without having to pay union dues. And the union's response, I think, properly so, is, well, you know, if you're having trouble with burnout, which so many nurses are, you want a union there to advocate for you, especially with the issue of staffing levels. But apparently that argument did not break through.
Yeah, it was a relatively close vote as I saw the final numbers, and there are a number of nurses who aren't happy with the idea that they are decertifying. So something that we'll have to follow along as that moves ahead now, as the Mayo Clinic nurses at the Mankato Hospital will no longer be part of the Minnesota Nurses Association union. Well, you have been speaking with Patrick Coulican. He is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. Again, go to minnesotareformer.com for the great journalism and the latest in Minnesota news and politics. Patrick, as always, thanks for the time today.
Good to be here.
Let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. You guys mentioned Matt Burke there. We got an update on the Matt Burke burger fiasco in St. Paul. It's a topic of high political tension in Minnesota. After two St. Paul restaurants recently took the former Minnesota Vikings player and Lieutenant Governor candidate's burger off their menus due to his comments on abortion and women's in careers, a West St. Paul restaurant is adding an item to their menus next month. Jameson's Irish Bar will be adding the Matt Burke Burger to their menus on August 7th. That's going to leave a bad taste in your mouth. According to Molly Rubenzer, the wife of executive chef Brian Rubenzer. Okay. Yeah, you can do that. Brian Rubenzer told the news that the restaurant is standing behind Burke due to years of support. Burke and his family showed the business through all the years during the pandemic. Some on social media took a liking to the announcement, calling Brian Rubenzer a class act. However, some also shared their displeasure with the news. This says a lot about your place and not in a good way, one person commented on the Facebook page. The Nook and Shamrock in St. Paul recently dropped the name Burke from their burgers after a video showed Burke suggesting that encouraging women to work, American culture is also promoting abortion. Hey, chicky pooch, get home, or else I can go over, I guess, and get a burger myself, I guess. General manager of Shamrock's Dan Casper told the Minnesota Reformer that two bars still love Burke, appreciate the support of the years. However, they took the name down to have customers not worry about left or right politics, which I can understand. Here's an interesting side note. Burke said that he will be at Jameson's in West St. Paul on August 7th to debut the burger, as well as taking donations for backing the Blue Line. Oh, great. I'm a guy, you know. If I was, a woman who heard Matt Burke basically say women with careers is encouraging abortion. And what was it about? Oh, that's right. People keep trying to play the rape card. Oh, yes. I don't know about you, but if I had someone who was, you know, taking away my rights over my own body, I might look for an opportunity to go voice my displeasure with that individual. Now, I'm not going to be able to make it over there on August 7th, but just letting everyone know, Jameson's on August 7th. Apparently, Matt Burke will be there in public. I don't know. Like I said, if you had a problem with what the guy is saying, you know, you're always looking for an opportunity. Maybe you could voice your personal opinion towards him. I'm just saying. I mean, it's up to you to, you know, what you want to do there. But in Jameson's West St. Paul, that's a Sunday, I believe it is, right? Sunday.
Yeah, it is a Sunday.
Those career women, they'll be off that day. Most of them will be. Oh, I don't know about you. I don't appreciate this there, Frankenstein. Burger. Once again, this disclaimer. Frankenstein wants nothing to do with Matt Burke. I'm a monster and all, but what the hell did he say? 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Let's play around in the numbers for the rest of this show. Why don't we? I love campaign finance time. So I think one of the things we can say, now granted, we got PACs that are out there that are going to try to help out Republicans, but man, Republicans across the board are not doing too well. Let's start with the old governor's race. You know, that ticket that Berkey boy is on. Tim Walz is absolutely kicking Scott Jensen's caboose on fundraising at this point. The Walz has raised a total so far of $6,300,000. Jensen's total haul so far is $2,250,000. $2,250,000, I should say it like that. $2,250,000. So when you look at cash on hand right now, Tim Walz has nearly $5 million, is $4,980,000 on hand. Jensen has $580,000. Right now, Walz has nine times more money than Jensen does. This isn't May or March. It's almost August, and he's got a nine times advantage on money. Wow. That is amazing. Because that's putting him in a pretty decent disadvantage. Walz right now, and going to Brian Bask's Twitter feed, Stoey Dad on Twitter, Walz has booked millions in fall TV ad time and started running commercials after this reporting period closed, so some money is tied up. Jensen report includes about $245,000 in radio and newspaper ads he's purchased. He has yet to book any television for the fall. Any. Wow. That is, you know, hey, money... The money on hand does not dictate who's going to win a race. But when you start seeing advantages like this, what you're actually seeing is it's not so much the money Walz has gotten. It's the money that Jensen hasn't gotten. It's the money that people are not giving to him right now because they're anticipating him losing. Why am I going to throw money into a toilet and just flush it? Because that's kind of what it is. That's a pretty astonishing amount. For once again, this is supposed to be a Republican year, mind you. That is an astonishing amount. Let's turn to the Attorney General's race, shall we? Keith Ellison, this is a more interesting race because when you look at the numbers together, they're pretty equal, but you have to remember there's two Republicans currently running. That's right. It's time for a Where's Wardlow? That's Doug Wardlow time. You know, and Jim Schultz. What was that group he was on the board of? It was there's never a medical emergency for a woman to have an abortion. He's kind of an extremist. So, total raise so far, Keith Ellison for the DFL for the Attorney General space, $935,000. Cash on hand, $572,000. He's got a pretty good amount of money there for an AG's race. Then comes Wardlow and Schultz. Now, Schultz is the Republican endorsed candidate, but he has made less money than Wardlow right now. Wardlow has raised $524,000. Schultz has made $409,000. Now, Wardlow, because he's trying to win this primary coming up here, has burned off more of his money. He only has $34,000 on hand. Schultz has $113,000, but once again, if doing my math there, it's what, 3.5 times less money than Ellison does right now. Don't get me wrong. There's going to be a lot of PAC money coming in here.
prepare yourself. We all know what's going to happen. The Republican entire narrative on that AG race is once again going to be black man, black Muslim man. That's going to be it. That's where it's going to go. That's the PACs. They're going to come in. So there's going to be money there. But it does tell you a lot that Wardlow has made more money than Jim Schultz. That Wardlow has made more money raised than Schultz. And Schultz is the endorsed Republican candidate. That's remarkable. If nothing else, I mean, clearly Schultz has had to spend some money to basically try to keep in this race to, to keep Wardlow from winning the primary. But still, whoever comes out of that, my guess is going to get an immediate influx of money. But that's interesting. And mind you, once again, so Ellison has made $935,000. Combined, the Wardlow and Schultz together are $933,000. So Ellison has outraised them both. They're burning through all that money to try to win this primary. There's not going to be like a war chest from the loser to go to the winner. You know what I mean? There's not, and plus the fact that I don't get the impression those two guys like each other a lot. Have you seen some of the attacks from Schultz on Wardlow and from the Minnesota GOP on Wardlow? That's not happy time. They're not BFFs at this point, I don't think.
Yeah, the Republicans don't like primaries, so they're not happy with Wardlow at all.
Yes. Secretary of State's race. Can we call it now? Seriously? Do we have to wait till November? Fine. Steve Simon has a bit of an advantage. He has raised $807,000. He has $678,000 on hand. Kim Crockett, by the way, fun fact for you on Kim Crockett. When she was at the Republican convention for the nomination process, she aired an anti-Semitic video, and the GOP applauded. Oh, wow. I know. That should basically prevent anyone from giving her any money because she aired an anti-Semitic video at the convention, and the GOP applauded it. Anyway, she has made just a little bit of money, $174,000 compared to $807,000 for Steve Simon. Steve Simon is well over, 4.5 times as much money he's earned. Cash on hand, well, Steve Simon has that $678,000 I mentioned. She's got a good $76,000. Oh, boy. Maybe some new drapes for the bunker she's hiding out right now. The Otters race is interesting. The Otter, Julie Blaha, I love you, Julie. Oh God, you're just one of my favorite politicians. Julie Blaha is great. And people, you need to get out there and help Julie Blaha win the state auditor's race. She does a great job over there, and she's just, we've had her on the air, 4 or 5 times. She's a hoot. She's just an absolute hoot, and love her. This is the one race where on the surface, you're saying to yourself, wow, what happened here? But if I may. Julie Blaha is the Democratic incumbent. She has earned a total of $110,000, a little more, on her race. On cash on hand is $31,000 cash on hand. Okay. So then all of a sudden it's a little bit eye-opening when you look at Ryan Wilson, the Republican, who we talked about. Exaggerates stories and doesn't seem to understand what the state auditor does. He seems to be implying the legislative auditor's job. I mean, remember that? We talked about that a few weeks ago. He seems to think the job of the legislative auditor is the job of the state auditor. So big surprise if he gets into office that, yeah, no, that's not what you do. But I'm sure someone's tried to clear that up with him. The amount of money raised, total raised for him is $173,000, which is, wow, quite a bit more than Julie Blaha. The cash on hand right now is $91,078 versus Julie Blaha, $31,000. But here's the issue. The Wilson listed no cash spending, but nearly $80,000 in in-kind expenditures with himself as the vendor. So if we take away the
$80,000, it would mean that he has made actually less money than Julie Blaha totally raised. And he has, and I'm not sure about this, if the $91,000 he has listed is including that $80,000, because if it is including that $80,000, well, he only has $11,000 on hand. And Julie Blaha is leading, which, by the way, would seem to match up with pretty much all the rest of the statewide races, at least there. So my guess is going to be is he's in kind. What are you doing in kind? I don't want to know what you're doing. Sorry. I'm sorry. What are you doing to yourself, man? Sorry. It's $80,000 or whatever he's doing to himself, but it's $80,000. What could I do to myself for $80,000? If you're not watching the show right now, boy, are you going to miss out, because I think it's time for us to kind of roll around in my mind what $80,000 of self-help could do for myself. I don't want to. Is that pencils? $80,000? That's a lot of pencils, man. Or is it signs? Is it something else? Dun, 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 dun. 952-946-6205. Now, while I let you all contemplate that disturbing image, let's take a break and I'll come back. I'll talk some more of the money earnings. I'll talk about some of the congressional races. And we got to get up into eight. We've got to go and turn that seat. We can turn that seat with that clown up there, with Stubby up there. We'll talk about that when I do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. $80,000 of self-help. Does he own a sign company? Does he make his own lawn signs or something like that? Is it something else? Hello. Hello, left hand. Hello, right hand. Well, left hand wants to give me $80,000. Well, right hand asks, what can you do with that $80,000? Oh, let me show you. Okay. I don't know. The intricacies of political financing escape me sometimes. Now, good. Well, never mind. No, I can't say that. Nope, can't say that. Cannot say that joke. I'll get fired. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's look around at some of the other candidates' races, shall we? All righty. Congressional District 1. Now, this is, I've got two goals for you right now, and you're going to understand. I think that I feel pretty confident about 4 and 5. Minnesota 4, Minnesota 5. I don't want to take anything for granted. I know that that McCollum and Ilhan Omar will both basically, like, don't ever say that. No, I feel pretty comfortable about the DFL winning those two seats. I'll talk about 2 and 3 in a second. You need to get down to 1 for the special election. That's going to be coming up here on August 9th. August 9th. You need to be down there and help out Jeff Ettinger down there. I think one can go to the DFL, but we got to work hard down there. Starting with the special election down in 1, Ettinger has led the fundraising down there. $801,000. Cash on hand, $249,000. Now, this is different than the AG's race because this is a special election on August 9th. Then we have the general election coming up here in November, all right? So what you've got is Brad Finstad is running against Ettinger in the special election, but he also has a primary challenger for that same exact day in Jeremy Munson, Dr. Jeremy Munson. I don't think he's actually a doctor. Finstad has trailed Ettinger in money raising. $609,000 is how much he has to spend there. He has not spent as much, though. It's $267,000 on hand right now, so he's a little bit ahead of Ettinger. Here's the interesting one. Munson has at $203,000. He has $209,000 cash on hand as of right now. So, and Munson's trying to, and Munson doesn't matter to Ettinger. Munson's trying to win the primary to challenge if Ettinger wins on the special election, Ettinger again in November. I believe Finstad's also on that primary ballot. as well. So it's kind of an interest. It is a weird thing going on down there. But the one thing you can take away from that, DFLers, is that Ettinger is leading. And once again, the entire game board changed the second the Republicans overturned Roe v. Wade. Get down to one. Help them out down there. See if we can get that seat. I think we can. I'm going to have, by the way, Jeff Ettinger is going to join us on Monday. He's going to be joining us in the 3 o'clock hour. So we're going to talk with him about his campaign to win that seat, the Minnesota one, for the DFL, like it was when under Governor Walz. Congressional 2, Angie Craig, $4,752,000. She has cash on hand, $4,744,000. Tyler Kistner, when he stops driving, $2,100,000. We'll call it that. Cash on hand is only $523,000. You got those reimbursement miles, man. Yeah, you know how many of those miles just pile up, man, when you're just driving all over the place. You know how that goes. That's a pretty stark, considering that's supposed to be a toss-up district for the Republicans, though a winnable one. The fact that he is, well, 9 times behind Angie Craig on cash on hand, that's a pretty big one. Dean Phillips, he has made $1,690,000. He has cash on hand, $794,000. Tom Wheeler has made only $317,000. Cash on hand is $228,000, so still a 3 times advantage, well over a 3 times advantage for Dean Phillips there. 4 and 5, you got Ember's got the lead in 6. 7, it goes to, you know, the Harpy up there, Michelle Fischbach. Fishy, as I like to call it. But Minnesota 8, let's go up there. Jen Schultz has done an amazing job. She's actually come back dramatically there. Stubby, has earned $1 million, basically. He has cash on hand, $1 million. So he's heading into November with that. Jen Schultz has now $209,000, cash on hand, $110,000. Reminder, once again, now that that overturning of Roe v. Wade has happened, that district is not nearly as a guarantee for the Republicans as you want to think. You need to get up into 8, which is not that far. By the way, Minnesota 8 starts right north of the metro area, as a matter of fact. So you can get into the 8 district pretty easily. Door knock, campaign, donate. Jen Schultz is a top-notch candidate up there. And the reality is even Republican women are furious about the Roe v. Wade being overturned. A lot of Republican women are. So, how much do you want to win it? Got to get down to 1 to help out Ettinger down in that special election. That's on August 9th. Got to get up into 8 and help Jen Schultz pull off a nice upset there and knock out Pete Stauber. That would be fantastic. Jen Schultz is a top-notch candidate, and we can win that district. Coming up, we got Devil's Radio, Native Roots Radio coming up here in the 6 o'clock hour. Have a good one. We're back tomorrow. Till then, see ya.